Thank you very much. So the first question is probably, why is somebody who's interested in orthopedics also interested in mild brain injury? So the background behind that is obviously, there's a lot of current media publicity towards sports-related concussion. I think a lot of what we've learned in terms of concussion comes from that area and that literature. So we wanted to leverage our experience in sports-related concussion and try and look at head injuries in military populations. I have nothing to disclose, and anything I say is my own opinion and reflects no official policy of anybody. And just a brief overview of what I'll talk about today. So first of all, traumatic brain injuries were common in military populations prior to the initiation of combat operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. OEF, Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan, and OIF, Operation Iraqi Freedom in Iraq, obviously. TBI subsequently emerged as what has been termed a signature wound of these conflicts, and a report out of the RAND Corporation estimated that nearly 320,000 service members who had been deployed to either theater of operation prior to October 2007 may be affected by traumatic brain injury. Studies have estimated the prevalence of TBI in military populations to be between 19 and 23%. And mild traumatic brain injury is the most common form of TBI in both civilian and military populations. A few recent studies have looked at trends in the incidence of mild traumatic brain injury in high-risk athletic populations. Among NCAA athletes or collegiate athletes, there was a 7% annual increase over about a 14-year period that was reported recently. And a recent report in interscholastic or high school sports showed a 16% annual increase in that population. No studies to date have looked at trends in the incidence rate of mild traumatic brain injury among military personnel, particularly looking at a period before the initiation of combat operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then in a period subsequent to that. So those were our objectives, really, to look at occupational and demographic risk factors or factors associated with mild traumatic brain injury in this population, and then to assess trends during the study period. So we conducted a retrospective cohort study looking at all active duty service members between 1997 and 2007. Our primary outcome of interest was incidence rates of physician-diagnosed mild traumatic brain injury. Our case definition, we used the recommendations of the Centers for Disease Control. They have a recommended definition for using administrative data to document mild traumatic brain injury, so we used that definition. Incident cases also had no prior history of injury. We included any diagnosis. We got our data from the Defense Medical Surveillance System, which captures all encounters that military service personnel in all four branches of service have with healthcare providers throughout the military health system. We used any diagnosis. That system allows for multiple diagnoses to be documented. We included ambulatory and hospital visits, and we also limited our definition of incident cases to the first occurrence from the time they entered military service. Person time at risk was available through the Defense Manpower Data Center, and we were able to calculate follow-up time that way. We already talked a little bit about the demographic and occupational factors that we looked at, and we used Poisson regression to analyze the data. So we'll talk a little bit about some of the results. During the study period, there were just over 98,000 incident cases of mild traumatic brain injury documented in the population. The overall incidence rate during the study period was 6.55 per 1,000 person years. All of the variables that we looked at were associated with mild traumatic brain injury, which is probably due to the size of our data set. But in multivariable models, after controlling for some of the other factors, age, rank, and service seem to be the most important factors. Those in the youngest age group were almost three times, the incidence rate was almost three times higher compared to those over 40. Those who were junior enlisted service members, the incidence rate was about 51% higher when compared to senior officers. And those in the Army had a rate that was about just over two times higher when compared to those in the Navy. When we looked at trends, there was an 8.5% annual increase overall during the study period in the instance of a mild traumatic brain injury. However, there was a significant upward trend in the last 2 years. The rate in 2006 and 2007 was 61% higher when compared to the overall aggregate rate for the previous years. We observed similar trends regardless of sex, age, race, deployment status, occupational group, branch of military service, and rank. However, the magnitude of these observed trends varied somewhat by subgroup. The average annual increase also was affected by deployment status. So those deployed to Iraq or recently in support of Iraq, the average annual increase was 38% in that group, 15% in those recently deployed to Afghanistan, 8% overall for those that are just here in the continental United States, and then 6% average increase for those who are deployed elsewhere, for example, South Korea. So just a couple of graphs. This provides the top line is the unadjusted incidence rates during the study period and the adjusted rates, and also gives some reference point as to when these operations were initiated in Afghanistan and Iraq. As you can see, the upswing in the last 2 years of the study. And this is a similar graph looking at incidence rates by DOD occupational code or Department of Defense occupational code. Those that are combat-related occupations obviously had they had similar rates prior to 2005. There were some difference there, but the trends were similar, but there was some divergence from 2005 onward. And these are rates by branch of military service. Once again, similar trends, just different magnitudes. And by military rank. So junior enlisted had the highest rates throughout the study period, and the rates look similar regardless of group over time, or the trends, not the rates. Rates are obviously different. So just some discussion. This is the first study we believe to look at, a population-based study to look at trends in the incidence rate of mild traumatic brain injury in military service members. Occupational factors had the greatest impact on trends, it appeared to be, and these are likely surrogate measures for a combat exposure. The sharp increase that we saw in the last 2 years of the study could be explained by several things. First, the rates of mild traumatic brain injury that we observed were consistent with the incident rates for IED attacks. That information is put out by the Joint Improvised Explosive Defeat Organization, Explosive Device Defeat Organization. They actually tracked that in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the rates look very similar to the incidence rates for mild traumatic brain injury. There are significant changes in screening policy in the DOD and the VA in late 2007, which may have had some impact on the rates that we observed in the last 2 years of the study. And then obviously the last 2 years of the study were consistent with the increased violence in certain areas, particularly in Iraq, as well as with increased military troop surges in those areas. And then finally, I kind of alluded to this in the introductory comments, but the rates we observed in military populations were quite similar to rates in other athletic populations. And just to illustrate that, the figure on the left is from a recent publication. Like I said, scholastic high school rates, and then on the right is military rates. And there's even though the rates are calculated with different measures, the overall trends are quite similar, which I think suggests that increased awareness from sports-related concussion and those areas may have some spillover effect into military treatment facilities and people treating military service members with concussion. So obviously, we all have strengths and limitations. So a list, our data pretty much is limited to active duty military personnel, may not be applicable to National Guard and Reserve component service members. Our definition relied on physician diagnosed cases. We know that many cases of concussion or mild traumatic brain injury may never be seen by a physician, so those are cases that may be missed or may not be documented, as well as cases that may be managed in theater and may never reach treatment levels that would be allow them to be documented. As a result, our rates are probably underestimates. And as far as some of the strengths, obviously we were able to document injuries for the entire military population, all four branches of service. We had precise follow-up information based on dates of entry into military service and dates of separation. And we were able to document incidence rates as opposed to prevalence rates, which many previous studies have done. We all know the difference between the importance of looking at the occurrence of new cases compared to existing cases in the population. So that's what one of the strengths that makes this study unique. Just overall conclusions, there's an overall 8% average annual percentage increase in the rate of mild traumatic brain injury in the population, with a sharp increase in the last 2 years, 2006 and 2007. All trends were similar regardless of the demographic and occupational factors that we looked at, although the magnitudes did vary. And occupational factors were the most important probably in terms of being related to the incidence rate of mild traumatic brain injury. Finally, I'd like to some acknowledgments. I'd like to acknowledge the congressionally directed medical research programs, post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury program for some funding that supported this study. My co-authors, all the military service members on active duty during the study period, as well as the healthcare providers that provided their healthcare. And finally, Dr. Angie Ike Cost at the Armed Forces Health Surveillance Center, who helped us with the study. And I guess everybody's done now, so I'll open up to questions for everybody. So, actually, I'll turn it back over to the moderator.
Dr. Weiler, I'm curious to know whether or not you did your analysis by age group and if there were any differences there, and also if you performed any analysis based on time of accident or incident. And the reason why I'm asking that specific question is because the university, I'm assuming, can implement a policy that states that students can only ride their scooters, at certain times when they're in class, and then that'll take some of the liability away from the university, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm. So I was just kind of curious, and lastly, if you investigated any further about the differences in why Greek and athletes prefer not to wear helmets.
On the first question, there was really no age differences, and we tortured the data as much as we possibly could to see if there were anything significant. We did notice, we did find a difference in helmet use by the type of license plate. I don't know if you noticed, they have a under 21 years of age license plate, and those people that had those type of license plates were less likely to wear a helmet because they don't have to, as long as they're riding a scooter that's 50 cc's or less. But otherwise, in terms of time, it made no difference. I mean, we have a pretty open campus, and they can ride their scooters freely to, from, and around campus. There's a couple areas that are restricted during certain parts of the day, but they're restricted to all motor vehicle traffic as well. So we didn't see anything with regards to time of day as well, all in the days. With regards to helmet use at the University of Florida, right now the university cannot make an ordinance or a policy that, I guess, supersedes the state law. You can't make it more stringent. So
even though it's private property?
It's state property, yes. It's quasi-state property, yes. So we are, in fact, after this this presentation, I have a call into the university about the exact topic that we're talking about. So they're hesitant to put forth a policy requiring a helmet use. Now, with regards to Greeks, I think a lot of it is a greater proportion of students, the fraternity houses, sorority houses are located in close proximity to the university. I think that's one thing. We also know that the football players too, especially the football players, but a lot of the athletes you know, they're going back and forth to their training facilities, to their classrooms, to their dining halls, to their residence facilities as well. And it's just a very convenient way. I mean, this is a large campus, massive in size. And so to get around, it's just a convenient way to get around. So.
Interesting. Can I follow on that?
Sure.
You might want to ask your university lawyers about whether it's possible to use economic incentives.
Mm-hmm.
You could have a requirement that helmets be worn unless. A cost, a fee that is waived if the motorcyclist wears, scooter driver wears the helmet.
Mm-hmm.
Economic incentives are not the same as mandates, and they are viewed differently legally.
Mm-hmm.
You might be able to use that kind of thing.
Thank you for the suggestion. Appreciate it.
Two main things I would say that have made a difference are taxes on cigarettes. New York City is one of the highest tax rates nationally. To buy a pack of cigarettes now is about $11 or $12. And also smoke-free areas. We ban smoking in workplaces. Now smoking is banned in parks and beaches. Both of those help.
Smaller proportion of them who are in marriages, a significantly larger proportion who are either single, divorced, or separated when compared to the Burgess data.
And did they have other jobs? Was this like a job that they took on
safely to make extra money? Or? So that's kind of the implication I got in VNIP. We did not ask that explicitly whether or not they had other employment. And that's just the sense I got from talking with the women and talking with the managers who said that actually a lot of them will work. Or the women particularly told me that they will work when their children are in school, but not when their children are on summer vacation.
Mm-hmm.
So summertime is actually a time a lot of women told me they weren't working because their children.
So it was more or less
mm-hmm.
hours.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And as far as the other job, did your question tease out if they had other jobs, or did they have access to insurance?
So we asked them about insurance status and kind of made it inclusive of any type of insurance, including any privately purchased insurance and any insurance they would get from another job. We did not tease out where the insurance came from or whether or not they had other employment.
I also work with the military folks. And I just have
the data for post-concussion syndrome looks much more similar to PTSD than it does for significant overlap in the diagnostic criteria between those two conditions, and I don't think we have accurately teased that out. I think there's some new data that's starting to come out that shows that there's clearly some kind of cellular level structural damage to the brain after a blast concussion, which may help explain some of these things. But we still don't know. I think we're still learning in that area. So as far as behavioral stuff, I think there are a lot of groups that are looking more at the behavioral aspects of that. The DOD since 2007 has funded a lot of research to look at not only assessment but also treatment for psychological health conditions and mild traumatic brain injury. So I think that information is going to be hopefully forthcoming in the next couple of years as that research starts to mature.
Hi, yeah, I have a question about the shift or state of epidemiologists. My question is, that fire terrorism funds are going down. I think a lot of people are shifting to the IV, and that may actually be the IV people in the long run. And so I know that there is layoffs, et cetera, but are a lot of the people, were you able to assess whether people are staying in the same position, just shifting departments? Because, I mean, once the IVT funding went out, I mean, that's actually a lot of IV was actually done before, at least for the local level, a lot of VT was done, IV was done for VT.
Yeah, that's a good point, and the way that our survey was written didn't quite get at that. We basically said, especially in this assessment, because it was designed to be rapid and brief, it really just asked the state epi to identify numbers, so we didn't really get to the level of an individual and which positions they would be in, but they just looked at how many epis there are. We actually asked for composite FTEs, so it could be a portion of somebody or not necessarily a full person. So I guess the answer is no, but it's definitely something that we know that happens in the state.
Well, you just said that somebody could actually fall into the category of
that? In terms of their funding?
Yeah. And then I'm sorry, how was that presented? Was that full FTE then?
So the numbers that we gave were like FTE, full-time equivalent, basically.
I have a follow-up to that. So there was a state epidemiologist to respond for each state? Because I know that's changed now, so I'm like, when did you have that question? Because every state doesn't have a state epidemiologist all the time.
Right, and so, I mean, we did it in fall of last year, and so it was based on the person who was the state epidemiologist or a contact.
Like the woman behind me, I've got questions for all of us, although I've already asked hers. Like her, maybe I'll just do it one at a time. I'll start from the end. When you were describing the quite evident change in the upward trend in 0607, being parallel to the athletics, I found myself wondering about the similarities or perhaps differences between change that occurs in military and non-military environments, which is sometimes from the top down and sometimes from the bottom up, in the recreational screening for mild traumatic brain injury. Parents are asking that their children be screened. It's not just top down, the screening will be done because there's a change in policy. Given that more screening is happening, I wonder if more military personnel are asking to be screened, regardless of whether the policy has changed.
So there definitely people are being screened mandatorily upon deployment and redeployment, which is really where we suspect most of the change or most of the difference, a lot of the difference in this has come from is because of deployment-related injuries. So there is mandatory screening pre-deployment and post-deployment, which should help to identify those folks, at least at that point. If we don't identify cases at that point, that they reemerge later on down the road, we don't have much impact or much ability to affect that until they report back for some sort of follow-up. So it's definitely a concern, but I think we're doing a much better job. I think it's definitely become
service members asking to be screened more often now than it used to be?
I think that's probably occurring. I think that anecdotally, I think yes, because of the increased awareness and mm-hmm. so much media publicity that yeah. the head injuries have gotten, not only in sports, but also related to military deployments. So I think that's probably part of it as well, mm-hmm. yes.
Okay. So my question for Monica. If I understood the slide right and I can dial fast, the survey was asking about salary freezes. I didn't see that it was also asking about salary reductions.
Yeah, I don't think we asked that question. We asked about freezes. We asked about things that are in essence salary reductions or furloughs and things like that. But I don't believe we asked specifically about reductions.
Okay. Let's ask about that next time. Because yeah. I'm in that category of people who have had an epidemiologist working at the state who has had his salary reduced. And I'd like to see how often that happens. And then my question for Dr. Shahrest, did I get that right?
Yeah.
It's not so much a question as an observation that you may want to ask about. When you're comparing the sample you got with the BRFSS on the item about cell phones, I don't know where Rhode Island stands in the progression of these things, but CDC is working very hard with state BRFSS programs to transform the BRFSS from being a landline telephone only survey to one that incorporates other modes such as cell phones and web interviews. If your data is from the period of time when it was a landline telephone only survey, you're going to have lower cell phone use for that reason alone.
That's absolutely correct. The data is from the 2010 BRFSS survey, which I think was still landline only at that point. That could account for the significant difference between the two, because I was also surprised by the number of people who reported that they didn't have a cell phone. I don't know anybody who doesn't have a cell phone. So that's very possible.
One way you might approach it is by looking at the BRFSS stratified by age, because
mm-hmm.
there's an awful lot of BRFSS respondents who are older.
Yes, and I think that was stratified by age. That BRFSS, all of the BRFSS data that we have in there is all stratified by age. So that was stratified. So that is still the younger. I mean, I think if we included even the older populations, it might be even lower than what we have.
And that I don't actually have a clear question for you, Dr. Coleman, right? It had to do with the logic of using mortality data that's based on the underlying cause as opposed to the multiple cause of death files that have all the contributing causes, because there are some conditions which I think you would get by including YLD. But I'm not sure. I know that when we've done analyses in my state looking at mortality, that we've gone through these arguments about, you know, do you want to use only the underlying first listed cause or underlying for mortality data, if you know that it undercounts certain things, like diabetes maybe, or hypertension. And certainly osteoarthritis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I just wondered if your group had thought at all about that issue of underlying versus multiple cause.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And years of life loss doesn't really look at other causes. And there's also the issue of comorbidity. The national researchers came up with this whole algorithm that if someone had comorbid conditions, they were assigned to one category for the disability conditions, and we followed all those assumptions. But it is a limitation to the study.
I don't know that it is a limitation. That's really what I was. And that's why I say it's a poorly formed question, because I don't have a clear idea. I mean, it may well be that it doesn't matter.
think some of the things that you miss with the mortality measure, you do capture in that disability measure. Something like osteoarthritis, that probably doesn't kill very many people, but the disability measurement of that is probably fairly accurate.
Sure. So we did obviously look at, and I kind of went over how we had to kind of make up our own questions for those because there aren't any validated assessment tools. And they did report a significant number of lower extremity injuries from, I used to have a picture of the shoes in my presentation because they're about 6 inches high on both sides, like platforms. So there's a significant number of lower extremity injuries and anecdotally numerous women who are working while injured. I saw one with a knee brace on it, still working. So I didn't ever put it in there, one, because we didn't have a comparison group for it, because we have no comparison questions. And you're right in that. I think it would be a really good area to touch on in terms of an intervention. But we asked mostly about the intimate partner violence, the mental health, and the drug, alcohol, and tobacco use questions in terms of our intervention-based questions. But I think it is a place where a possible intervention could absolutely be utilized. Just maybe even just a knowledge about, you know, ankle strains and knee strains and what it takes to heal a knee strain and when it's appropriate to go back to work and when it's not. And it wouldn't be a very difficult health intervention to do.
Because, right, you know, a lot of these jobs are assuming you pay that day.
Mm-hmm.
That if they do get an injury, that may affect their pain, everything. So
absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think my thought was that if you could get across to them that it may only be a couple of days that they need to rest this injury, and then after a couple of days they can go back to work, as opposed to continuing to work on an injured ankle where you're going to injure it more and then you're going to be out of work for months. Just kind of getting that sense of education across, and that may help prevent further injuries in the future. But in terms of the immediate need for money, you know, I don't know if that would help that. Absolutely not.
I have time for one more question.
Dr. Cameron, we work at Walter Reed Army Institute Research, and we do TBI disability information, or we're currently studying the TBI disability. And we actually see a similar dip. You have your talk about your increase in 2007, but there's a dip in 2005. And we see a dip in disability in 2008 for TBI. So we're wondering, we don't have an explanation for our dip. Do you have an explanation for yours?
For 2005.
Yeah.
I don't really have an explanation for that. It was also seen in the high school, almost in the high school. So it's a very interesting question why that dip is there. I think part of it may be due to the operational tempo, is that, you know, as things were kind of transitioning, there was a period during deployments where things kind of were stable and under control, and then in 2006 is when things really started to go downhill. So I think that might be part of it, but that's just my best guess, honestly. So, but yeah, I think that's the best answer I have, I guess. But if you have any insight, I would be glad to hear.
No, we see the back half. So these people that you have there, we will then see if they get stable later.
Sure.
On.
The more interesting question is when we looked at traumatic brain injuries, we saw a dip in the early 2000s, an increase, kind of a significant increase, which is more difficult for us to try and explain, I think. So, but if you have any insight on that, that's a different presentation, but I'd be glad to talk to you offline.
Well, I'd like to thank all of you all. These were very, very interesting topics, and I truly enjoyed your presentation. And